Today is Monday, March 20th. We're going to review muscle information and start the nervous system today. Sunday evening. That's right. Yeah. Sunday night into Monday morning, that time change.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to start excitation contraction coupling. This process is the one that is used to tell muscle cells to contract, and it's a two-part process. It starts off with the excitement of the muscle cell. So what we're looking at is a motor neuron with a nerve impulse traveling down the length toward those axon terminals, and you just saw the wave of action potential travel across that skeletal muscle. We're going to zoom in, and we're going to work really close in detail at that axon terminal and its relationship with the underlying skeletal muscle cell. This very specific relationship is not called a motor unit. That's the big picture. What is this very specific relationship called? Well, the relationship between the axon terminal and the muscle cell is a neuromuscular junction. Good. You're looking at an axon terminal. There comes a nerve impulse or action potential. It arrives at the end of your axon terminal. And that excitement or that wave of nerve impulse will open up certain types of channels here. What types of channels must be open for these vesicles of neurotransmitter to leave?
Calcium.
Good. There goes calcium rushing into your axon terminal. That calcium must be inside your muscle cell to allow for those vesicles to release their acetylcholine. So this process of moving those vesicles is kind of like a blister popping. It's exocytosis. And now these acetylcholine molecules come in contact with receptors on the plasma membrane of our muscle cell. What happens to those channels when those acetylcholine molecules bind?
They open
and they let sodium in. Good. So you notice here in red, those are sodium ions rushing in. We're going to ignore the blue for right now. And the entry of those sodiums inside our muscle cell cause the muscle cell to become excited. And that is excitation. We've excited the muscle cell. You're going to notice that we've got T-tubules sticking down like this one here, okay, and there's another one over here. Down below is a lacy sarcoplasmic reticulum. There goes the nerve impulse, that excitement wave. What are we going to tell those sarcoplasmic reticula to release?
Calcium,
yeah. So actually two times here that we need calcium to be present, once in our axon terminal and then second here in our muscle cell. Well, if you want to stop the excitement inside your muscle cell, we've got to recycle acetylcholine. We use an enzyme called what?
ACHE.
Okay, and acetylcholinesterase recycles acetylcholine into two components, an acetic acid or acetyl component and choline. And where do those components go?
Axon
terminal. Good, so they're recycled back into the axon terminal. For those who have had a psych class, they often call this process of recycling a reuptake process, and that helps us to prevent what from happening?
Constant contraction,
right? Because every time you excite that muscle cell, it's going to say, time for me to contract. Okay, one more time through excitation. You're looking at a motor unit. That's the relationship between one set of skeletal muscles and one motor neuron. That's the relationship you see here. When you zoom in, you'll notice that there is a set of axon terminals that sit on that muscle cell or muscle fiber. And the specific relationship between the axon terminal and the skeletal muscle cell is known as what? Neuromuscular junction. Good. So we're going to zoom into that relationship. There is a gap of space, you'll notice, between the two. That gap of space between our axon terminal and muscle cell is called?
Synaptic
cleft. Good. So you noticed a wave of excitement, which is a nerve impulse or an action potential, arrive in our axon terminal. And that wave of excitement opens up calcium channels, Why is it important for calcium to rush into your axon terminal? Yeah, release the acetylcholine. So the presence of that calcium allows for these vesicles full of acetylcholine to rupture. And by what membrane transport process do they move into your synaptic cleft?
Exocytosis,
good. When they travel across the synaptic cleft, where do they bind? Good, receptors on those sodium channels. And in response to their binding, what happens to our channels?
They open.
They open, good. Now, normally sodium is kept outside your muscle cell, but now that we've opened these sodium channels, sodium goes where? Rushes inside, right. So you'll notice that these things, they look like lettuce leaves, don't they? Once they open and the sodium rushes in, we actually change the environment inside our muscle cell. We've now excited our muscle cell with the influx of positive cations. Down here at the bottom, that stuff is the sarcoplasmic reticulum. This piece here is a T-tubule. There comes the wave of excitement. That means that sodium is rushing in all along the length of that sarcolemma, and that's going to cause excitement and contraction in our muscle cell. Now, we don't want to continue to excite our muscle cell because what would happen to our muscle?
Constant
it would ache, yeah, constant contraction. So how do you get rid of the excitement?
ACHE,
good. What specifically does ACHE recycle? Acetylcholine. Yeah, recycles acetylcholine. And what happens to the acetylcholine that's been recycled? Good, there it goes, back up in the axon terminal. This is a split second where you can do it again in just a split second again. So if you decide to move, relax, move again, that's how fast we can recycle and reuptake those acetylcholines. Okay, so that process alone is excitation. And what I'd like to go through now is re-step through cross-bridge cycle or muscle contraction. Before we do that, do you have any questions? How are you doing with the process of excitation? So let's walk through muscle contraction. This is a process that is coupled with excitation. And what we're looking at is a muscle cell sarcomere. That is a specific piece of a myofibril. We know that myofibrils are the organelles within our muscle cells. To kind of give ourselves perspective, what we're looking at here are various myofilaments. You see the red thick filaments and the yellow thin filaments. Which ones are anchored to those Z lines? Thin, good, thin filaments. Now, what we're seeing here is an up close of a thick filament with its myosin head. We have thin filaments with a rope of tropomyosin and a complex of troponin. To which of those three components will calcium bind? Troponin, good. And keep in mind that calcium is stored where?
In the SR.
In the SR, good. So looking at this picture, we know that we're ready for muscle contraction because we've got calcium bound to our troponin complex. The myosin rope is slid out of the way, and the binding sites are revealed on those actin filaments. So let us get this head relaxed. We're going to lay it back into its normal cocked position using ATP, and then we're going to release it again for a cross-bridge cycle. Okay, so you have a head here on the thick filament. It's ready to go to bind to our thin filaments. When it reaches up and binds, what do we form?
Cross-bridge.
Cross-bridge, good. That alone is not enough to produce muscle contraction. What must happen to that head next? Power stroke. Yeah, power stroke. So you just saw a power stroke take place. Notice what happened to your thin filament. It was moved. It was pulled by that head. Now we're going to have to repeat the process So what powers the release of the head?
ATP.
ATP, good. The head unbinds from the binding sites on the actin filaments. It relaxes back into a cocked position, and then it's ready to go for another cross-bridge cycle. I think this is the best part of this video. You get to see those heads literally walking along those thin filaments. Notice the thin filaments are being slid. Those heads pull them, the heads release, they pull again, and this is just like rowing your boat, right? Watch what happens to these filaments as those heads pull. What's happening to the distance between your two Z lines?
Shortens.
Good. That H zone disappears. What happened to your I band when you shortened that sarcomere?
It disappeared.
It disappeared too. Oh, you may have noticed there goes those calcium ions. So when the calcium ions are restored back into your SR, what happens to the rope of tropomyosin? Good. Covers back up those binding sites. That way we're ready to repeat the process again when necessary. But if you cover those binding sites, can you perform muscle contraction?
No.
Okay, so what you just watched is actually a bigger picture called the sliding filament theory. And the whole issue here is that we are sliding filaments. The only thing we shorten are those sarcomeres. So the distance between the Z lines is the only thing that shortens. You may have noticed there, none of those filaments actually bunched up and shortened. Okay. One more time through contraction. So they're going to zoom in here on a sarcomere. Can you tell me what a sarcomere is? Good. It's a unit from Z line to Z line, and it sits within an organelle called a what? Myofibril. Yeah, myofibril. If you zoom in on a sarcomere, this is what you see. You see these thick filaments made up of a protein called myosin, and you see thin filaments made up of a protein called actin. There's actually two other proteins involved in a thin filament. You'll notice a rope-like tropomyosin, and you'll also notice a complex here called troponin. So which of those three components of your actin filament binds calcium?
Troponin,
good. And by the way, where does that calcium come from?
SR.
From the SR, good. So we know this actin filament is ready for muscle contraction. How do you know? You can see the binding sites, good. And those binding sites mean it's time for that myosin head to reach up, form a cross bridge, and then power stroke, which means to pivot that head. We're watching right now what it takes to release the head. What powers the release or unattachment?
ATP.
ATP, good. So this head is sitting in a cocked position. That means it's ready for muscle contraction. And the second thing we're looking for is the actin binding sites are revealed. You can see them right there. There's some over here. And when that head binds to your actin filament, it forms a
cross bridge.
Good. That alone is not enough to move the muscle. What must happen to the head? Power stroke. Good. There it goes. Just like swinging a golf club. So the movement of that power stroke caused a change in the position of that actin filament. What just happened to your actin filament? It slid. Yeah, that's that sliding filament theory. But we've got to continue to release, bind, pivot with the power stroke to complete pulling the muscle shorter. So in order to release the head, you have to power it with ATP. And since those binding sites are still available, we're going to form another cross bridge and slide this thin filament once again. So you can see it's over and over. We bind, we pivot and power stroke, we release. We do this so many times that we eventually pull those thin filaments and make them slide past our thick. So when we pull those thin filaments, notice none of these filaments bunch up and shorten. What is the only thing to shorten in this picture? Sarcomere, right, the distance between those two Z lines. There was the H zone, it was gone. IBAMs also disappeared. How do you know this muscle here is relaxed?
Because
you can see the sarcomere. You can see the sarcomere spread out, you got an H zone, you got Z lines, right? So when you're done with the muscle contraction process, calcium is stored where? Back in the SR. What do we cover those binding sites with? Tropomyosin, right, and that means we're no longer available for binding and cross-bridge formation, so muscles must relax. Okay, so that's the second process known as contraction. It involves a theory called the sliding filament theory. Any part of either process, excitation or contraction, that I can help you with.
Whenever it's relaxed, you can see the H-zone.
Correct. Whenever it's relaxed, you see H-zone and IBAN. That's right. We talked a little bit in class last week about isotonic and isometric contractions. Related to this process, can you tell me what happens during an isotonic contraction? You form a cross bridge. Do you pivot and power stroke the head?
When did we talk about
it? I think it was Monday, or it might have been Monday. So if you've got an isotonic contraction, those actually produce muscle shortening. So if you produce muscle shortening, you do exactly what we saw here. The myosin head binds and forms a cross bridge. It pivots and does a power stroke. It releases, relaxes, and then it repeats the whole process again. So simple movements like contractions of extension and flexion, abduction and adduction, those are all isotonic contractions. Can you tell me, though, an example of an isometric contraction?
Standing up.
Standing up, good. Anything else?
That was the wall sit and stuff like that.
The wall sit, yeah. Pushing against a wall, sitting against a wall, standing, okay? Even doing push-ups where you leave your arms in an extended position. That means the head forms a cross bridge, but no power stroke is going to occur, okay? So if you need that info, let me give you a page number for it. Yeah, number 4 on page 85. Since we're on this page, let me bring your attention to the bottom where it says, how do smooth muscles contract? You notice right off the bat, smooth muscle does not have a light and dark striation pattern. Smooth muscle instead has no striations or banding pattern. That doesn't mean it has no troponin, tropomyosin, actin, or myosin filaments. That just means they're arranged in such a way that we don't see a light and dark banding pattern. Here's a slightly different way those muscle cells are constructed. Now, when smooth muscle contracts, it will do so over a long-term period, and the contraction is meant to be sustained. That's different from a skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle gets tired after a time period, and it's not really meant for long-term contractions, or at least most skeletal muscle is not. One big job of smooth muscle is a rhythmic tight contraction. You've heard this word, I'm sure. It's called peristalsis. So can you describe how peristalsis works? That's it. One ring contracts. The other ring relaxes, the other ring contracts, the previous ring of muscles relax. So we often have not only ring-shaped muscles surrounding our organs, we also have longitudinal muscles that run the length of the organ. And that allows us to milk and move blood through our vessels, food through our digestive tract, and urine through our urinary system. Okay. So just wanted to mention smooth muscle down there. Have any questions on smooth muscle or on this page?
Can you explain that
again? Do you ever use a tube of toothpaste where you squeeze sometimes, and then other times you take your hand at the end and you milk it from the bottom to the opening? That's what peristalsis is. sometimes it's squeezing circular muscles, and then sometimes it's milking length of the organ. So we'll come back to that. That's a big topic we cover in Bio 211. Let's see, page 86 and 87 are for your practice. I'll leave those alone for you and take you over to page 88. At the very top of your page, you'll notice the term muscle tension. This is provided by cross bridges in a constant state of semi-excitation. So mild stimulation or mild excitation will let a lot of your muscles stay somewhat contracted all the time. Imagine if that was not the case. What would happen to your physical state?
You'd be wore out all the time.
Or imagine sitting or standing. If you didn't have your muscles in a mild state of contraction all the time, what would happen to you? You'd fall over, yeah. Yep. So by keeping your muscles mildly contracted and mildly stimulated, that keeps your muscles in a semi-state of constant contraction. Keeps you upright, keeps you from falling out of your chair. So if we have a bigger job to do, we can perform what's called a grade of response. And that means that we can increase the frequency or the number of muscles being stimulated. I might have used an example last week of picking up something lightweight like a remote. That doesn't require very many motor units. But to pick up the table, which is obviously heavier, I have to use more motor units to stimulate and lift a heavier load. So that's kind of what we're looking at here in terms of a grade of response. You can actually measure the response of a muscle to its stimulation, and this is called a myogram. In fact, that's what you're looking at here in this image. This is an electrical response to ion movements within a muscle cell. So EKGs are in fact myograms. Fetal monitors that detect baby movements and contractions of the uterus, those are also myograms. So anything that detects electrical activity and a muscle's response is basically considered a myogram. EEG, that would probably do it to some extent, except there's no contraction there. Let's see, let me start you with the phases of a muscle twitch. First off, I know you've all experienced one of these irritating little they're kind of the nuances of your nervous system, right? They're not the normal way for your nervous system to operate. So when you've got a muscle twitch, I know you think that everybody in the world can see your eye blinking or winking or whatever it's doing that's driving you nuts. But a twitch is not the normal way for a muscle to behave. The twitch is not enough to produce a full-blown muscle contraction. It may, in fact, be one motor unit or one muscle cell producing that twitch. Really not enough to produce any kind of full-blown movement. So look at the timeline at the bottom here. We're looking at milliseconds. We are looking on the scale of 5 to 40 milliseconds. All of this happens under a half of a second. So, you know, when your eye is twitching or whatnot, you know, you feel like everybody's watching you and you've got this blinking or winking going on. That all occurs within a half of a second or less. So let me start you out with the stimulus here. That stimulus occurs during the latent period. And on your worksheet, you'll notice the latent period is the excitation period. All right, go with me. Action potential arrives in your axon terminal. What ions come into your axon terminal?
Calcium.
Okay, calcium lets a neurotransmitter known as acetylcholine, good, ACH, that leaves by exocytosis and it travels out into a gap of space called synaptic cleft. Once it's in the synaptic cleft, it travels across to the neighboring cell. It binds to a receptor sitting on a blank channel.
Sodium.
Good. Binds that sodium channel. The sodium channel opens up. What rushes into your muscle cell?
Sodium.
All of that happens in five or less than five one hundredths or one thousandths rather of a millisecond. All of that, that's extremely fast. So now that you've excited your muscle cell with the entry of sodium into the muscle cell, we can start the next phase called the contraction phase. All right, tell a story with me. The entry of sodium into your muscle cell tells your SR to release stored what?
Calcium.
Calcium, good. Calcium then comes to your troponin complex, binds that complex. What happens next? Good. Tropomyosin reveals your binding sites. Those binding sites are going to be critical because myosin heads reach up and form
cross
bridges. Good. Those cross bridges then lead to a power stroke, which is a pivoting of that head. What powers the release of the head for a repeat?
ATP.
ATP. Good. So we continually bind, make a cross bridge, power stroke, pivot, release over and over until we shorten what? The sarcomere, good. All of that just happens during this contraction phase, okay? And you'll notice that as we are binding, pulling, releasing, binding, pivoting, releasing, notice the muscle tension starts to peak. Okay, well eventually there's no more acetylcholine. What recycled it?
ACHE.
We're now getting into the relaxation phase. Since there's no more acetylcholine, what happens to the calcium bound to your troponin? Goes back to the SR, and now we can cover up the binding sites on those actin filaments. What rope-like structure does that covering for us?
Tropomyosin.
You'll notice it actually takes longest to clean up the mess that we've created, but eventually we've relaxed the muscle and this muscle twitches over. So all of that, the excitation and the contraction and the following relaxation, less than a half of a second in time. So that's incredible to think about how annoying a muscle twitch is and what's actually happening to produce that muscle twitch. Okay, so take a look at this picture. It's over on page 89, top of your page. I would, because it's part of that story of getting everything to relax. By the way, the explanation for this is on the bottom of page 88. You'll notice number 2 near the bottom of page 88 is called TREPPE. It's spelled T-R-E-P-P-E. You'll notice it says there, during TREPPE, if a skeletal muscle cell is stimulated immediately after its relaxation period, the contraction will produce a slightly higher tension than the previous contraction. So you'll notice that tension rises just a bit. But the problem is, you'll notice that using this picture, these black arrows represent the stimulation from the nerve impulse. They don't come close enough together. They're too far apart. And since they're far apart, the muscle fully relaxes. You stimulate it again with acetylcholine, and then it peaks a little higher with its muscle tension. That's not really enough to produce a full-blown muscle contraction. So what we need to do is get those stimulations a little closer together. And if we can move those stimulations rapid fire, what are we not going to give your muscle cell a chance to do?
Relax.
Yeah, that's critical. Don't let your muscle cell relax. And look what happens every time we stimulate it. What happens to the peaks here?
Higher and higher.
So that's greater and greater tension, which means I have the ability to pick up and move whatever I need to do. So those peaks of muscle tension come with a greater frequency of stimulation. Eventually, you'll notice in the last picture, this is fused or complete tetanus. We are coming so quickly with rapid fire stimulations, our muscle cell has no chance for what? Yeah, no chance for relaxation. Once it gets up there with its tension, it just keeps on maxing out, and then we see a high level of tension and an ability to do work. Now, most of us don't get to the point of fused or complete tetanus. Fused or complete tetanus is actually really painful. It's very uncomfortable. You ever experienced this?
Charlie horse,
yeah. Muscle cramps and Charlie horses are fused or complete tetanus. Very uncomfortable to get to that point. So when we're moving about and, you know, using our bodies, we are operating somewhere around unfused or incomplete tetanus and up here getting toward fused or complete tetanus. But yeah, we don't want to necessarily be in fused tetanus. That's a Charlie horse or a muscle cramp, and that's very painful. since we're on the topic, I thought I'd mention to you a couple of common things you've probably heard about. My mama always told me, don't walk in the yard barefoot. There could be rusty nails. You could step on them. You could get tetanus. You heard the story. Okay. This story has some iteration. Don't mess with the rusty tools. Don't touch the rusty rake. Don't do this. Don't do that, right? If you happen to get a open cut on your skin, there is a bacterium in the soil that also lives on, you know, yard tools, for instance, and this bacterium is called Clostridium. If Clostridium gets into your bloodstream, it can reproduce, and a toxin it makes is going to cause a lot of release of acetylcholine. So if you release a lot of acetylcholine, which one of these pictures on the myogram are you going to be most like? Used, yeah. That's a cramp, that's a Charlie horse, that is lockjaw. So for a lot of people, their muscles actually go into complete contraction, and that's what you notice here, this writhing contraction, until your body can kill the bacteria, which may take weeks or months. And in some cases, the body can't kill the bacteria, and unfortunately that results in the death of the person. So nowadays we have a shot called a tetanus shot, and that shot is supposed to prevent the toxin from building up in our bloodstream and that bacteria being able to do us damage. So that's why they recommend a tetanus shot every 10 years to make sure that you're up to date in case you do end up getting, you know, cut or something into your bloodstream with this bacterium. So imagine life before modern times, before antibiotics. If you were shot, whether it was by a cannonball or a bullet 200 years ago, if that bullet carried Clostridium on it and it passed through your body, that Clostridium could leave an infection in your body that would linger perhaps for months, and you would go through those very painful full-body contractions. They say that something like 60 to 80% of people died from this stuff, from Clostridium or lockjaw, and I guess the unfortunate ones were the ones to suffer through it for months until their body got rid of the infection. So that had to be an extremely painful thing to go through. Speaking of painful, here's a black widow spider. I want to show this specifically because it's one of our two poisonous spiders in the state of South Carolina. Where does this one live? Ooh, where at? In your house?
Not mine. Yes. I don't know if it was on him when he was in outside and then he came in and kind of sat him. They got him on the side of his leg.
Ooh.
Before we knew what it was. I mean, when I first saw it, I thought maybe, okay, he just has a little blood pipe. And then within like 3 days, it was
blow up.
I mean, I wish I could show you a picture. It is gruesome. It had like a little hole. I mean, once they drained it, it was a hole, and then there was like another hole, like where you could see the infection going into like the.
Wow.
It was gross.
How long did it take to go away completely?
Well, he was out of work for a month. Because he had to get it drained and packed every single day.
Oh, that's awful.
And he had to do, he works at a doctor's. So they did IV therapy there, so he would get IV therapy to keep him out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to cut it and drain it, and it wasn't
horrible. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty bad scenario.
It was.
Yeah.
I freaked.
I didn't know. I've never known anybody to do that one. So.
Like I said, just looked like a little sting bite, like a little swollen.
Started looking pretty innocent, and then.
Yeah, and then I marked it,
mm-hmm.
And every day it was getting bigger. And then the necrosis.
That's
when they had to start digging it out.
Yikes, that's not like not a good scenario. No.
But it does happen.
You're right, it is dark places. These spiders tend to like to be left alone. They're the kinds that, you know, unless you provoke them, they're not necessarily going to bite. But, you know.
It doesn't hurt when it bites.
Which is really scary because you may not even know what got you.
It doesn't hurt until 8 hours
afterwards. Oh, wow. Yeah. These classically have a red hourglass on their abdomens. You can see in this picture here that red hourglass. That's what's to look for. And the dangerous thing about a black widow spider is it produces a toxin called a latrotoxin. And it too will increase the amount of acetylcholine being released from axon terminals. And so let's go back to our picture. The more acetylcholine released, the more of which stage here do you see? Fused, yeah. So it can produce muscle contractions that lock up and don't relax. So So if, for instance, that muscle or that toxin goes to your diaphragm, your breathing muscle, it can make it difficult for your diaphragm to relax between breaths and give people something like pneumonia. I bet so, with that situation. Well, if you do home canning, then home canning is a tricky thing because if you don't can your home goods correctly, like corn or beans or tomatoes, you can introduce a toxin from a bacterium called Botox into your home canned goods. So, you know, that's why when we buy canned goods from the grocery store, if they've been punctured in any way, we certainly don't want to open and eat those foods because of botulinum toxin. Well, who would think that we would turn that toxin into a cosmetic feature, but we do. And so Botox comes from botulinum toxin. It is yet another kind of bacterial toxin. This one, however, you'll notice decreases acetylcholine release. So if you don't have enough acetylcholine, do you do any of this? You can't. So if your brain tells your muscles to contract, you may get a little increase there in muscle tension. But for the most part, the muscles stay relaxed and paralyzed. And that's why people use Botox, is to paralyze the muscles around their face. It prevents wrinkle formation. You'll notice in this picture, they actually show you all the injection sites for Botox. Now, it doesn't last but, say, several months, and then the process has to be repeated. They also use Botox right now to get rid of hyperhidrosis, which is excess sweating in the armpits, the hands, and the feet. So there are good uses for Botox injections in addition to cosmetic features. I've heard that too, yeah. So you're so focused on that hurting that you forget about the migraine. Is that how it works?
I don't know, but she got it the other day and she said she woke up and, like, instantly she could feel a difference.
Oh, wow.
But I just couldn't imagine getting that piercing. Yeah, that's
a very sensitive area.
I have it.
You do?
Yeah.
Migraine.
It absolutely works. I had a terrible migraine when I went to get it, and I don't get piercings. The only other piercing I have is just my one hole on my ear. And I closed my eyes when she did it, and when I opened my eyes, my head was clear. Now, I still get migraines, but they're not nearly as bad, and they don't last me long.
Interesting. Yeah, I had not heard about that.
It comes from acupuncture practice.
That would make sense.
That's where acupuncture is.
But you just got a permanent, do you have a regular size stud earring in there?
It's like a bar. I'll tell you about it after class if you want.
Okay. They said depending on which side of your head hurts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I go as a group, we'll get it.
Do you get migraines?
Yes. I get them with visual auras.
I get them maybe twice a year.
That's lucky. Oh, that's awful.
I can't look at the light. But then the next day, besides your eyes being swollen.
Yeah. Oh, that's not fun. Oh, I know. Just wear a mask until it's gone, right?
We take them out and see.
Yeah.
We've got to let them do it.
Okay. How about questions on page 88? Okay. Last little bit there on page 89. Under your myogram, it says number 2. How do muscles increase tension? And it says through recruitment. Now, recruitment involves increasing the number of muscle units that are stimulated. So if you are going to pick up a heavier object, you need to recruit additional motor units. Those motor units, by the way, will cycle on and off. And if you've ever carried heavy boxes for a friend who is moving or for your own self, you'll notice that sometimes you feel like you're going to drop the box. You know that your arms are tired. And those motor units have all cycled on and off, and they're all basically exhausted. So you can eventually have muscle fatigue and drop the box. All right. Just a little bit about the information down below. If you just want to read through that, you're welcome to. I'm not thinking there's any test questions on fast and slow fibers. You'll want to look at the terms hypertrophy and atrophy. Those are pretty commonly used terms, but just look at fast and slow twitch fibers. I don't believe there's any test questions. I'll make sure there are none on there for fast and slow fibers for next week.
So no questions?
Yeah, no questions on fast and slow fibers, but do look at hypertrophy and atrophy. What's that?
It's on the quiz.
It's on the quiz, okay. Don't worry about it there for the test.
But hypertrophy.
Yeah, hypertrophy and atrophy, I would look at those. Last little bit here is over on page 90, three pathways for generating ATP. Okay, so ATP is actually needed for several times during muscle contraction. We know one specific time it's needed is for the powerment of that head to be released from that cross bridge. So ATP is critical for muscles to be able to work. We need to be able to generate it on demand. Now, let's go back and review. We know that ATP is an energy molecule. It's also a nucleic acid built from a sugar called ribose. It has a base called adenine. And the most important part are those three phosphate groups. If you remove one of those phosphate groups, you have a low energy form called ADP, which is adenosine diphosphate. When you add on a phosphate group, you transform ATP, which now is a high energy group. That means you can do work with ATP. Let me explain it to you this way. This is like a bank account. If you have no money in your bank account, you have the low energy form called ADP. When you make a deposit, that's like adding on a phosphate to the ADP molecule. Now you've got money in the bank and you have a high energy form called ATP. ATP can do work for you because what you do is you take off that third phosphate group like a credit card, you apply it to do work, and then you re-add on that phosphate group for storage there. So I think of ADP as no money in the bank, but ATP is money in the bank. You can now do work with ATP. Okay, and so the easiest, fastest way to make ATP is through aerobic cellular respiration. The prefix term there, aerobic, means what? Air? Oxygen. Yeah, aerobic means with oxygen. So aerobic cellular respiration occurs in the mitochondria. This process uses the oxygen in the air that we breathe. It also uses glucose in our foods. And you'll notice that per glucose molecule, you make on average 34 to 36 ATPs. Hey, if this was gas mileage, this is good bang for your buck. Okay? In terms of efficiency, aerobic cellular respiration is the way to go. You get about 34 to 36 ATPs per glucose molecule. Okay, so here's the downside. We really don't store ATP. So when you start increasing your demands for ATP through exercise, notice that we're going to convert to the second process called, this is a mouthful, direct phosphorylation of ADP by creatine phosphate. Okay, so we'll transform over to direct phosphorylation by creatine phosphate. So, as you pack up and leave today, for about 15 seconds, you have a little booster coming from CP, which is creatine phosphate. That's going to give you about a 15-second extra supply of ATP. So sitting here right now, we're all making ATP aerobically. That means we're transforming glucose and oxygen into around 34 to 36 ATPs. The minute you start becoming physically active, you kind of kick it up a notch with a booster supply from creatine phosphate. So here we go. We've got ADP. Remember, that's our low energy form. We borrow the phosphate, there it is, from creatine phosphate. Now we make ATP, and ATP is the high energy form. That's the one we can do work with. That's the form we want to have. But you'll notice you can only use one creatine phosphate to make one ATP molecule. Not incredibly efficient in terms of making ATP. So this is not a good bang for your buck. It's not efficient. It's just a way to boost your exercise the minute you start moving. About 15 seconds is what you've got from this. So what happens if you continue to exercise? You know, you pack up your book bag, you walk to the parking deck or out front to your car. The more you move, the more you exercise, you're going to run out of creatine phosphate. So how do you supplement your demands for ATP? It's the last form. It's anaerobic respiration. Yes, so anaerobic respiration is a way to supplement your ATP production. Anaerobic as a prefix means no oxygen. Yep, no oxygen.
You said it's a way to supplement.
Supplement your ATP production. So we will tap into your body's glucose supplies in the bloodstream first. We'll transform those glucose molecules directly into ATP without using oxygen. This is not efficient. You'll notice that you only make two ATP per glucose molecule. That is not an efficient way to go. After you burn through your glucose supplies in your bloodstream, you then tap into your glycogen supplies. Where is glycogen stored? Liver and muscles, yeah. So you start burning through that glycogen supply, it breaks down to form glucose, and again, you're looking at 2 ATPs per glucose, not very efficient. Finally, if you burn through your available glucose and glycogen supplies, you now tap into your fat storages, and fat will then break down to form glucose, and again, not a very efficient way to do it, but this is how you lose weight. Okay, so to lose weight, you have to be in anaerobic respiration. That means you're taking glucose, glycogen, and then fats, transforming them into ATP. So that's why exercise can benefit us in terms of weight loss, because that's one of the ways to get into anaerobic respiration. There's a great demand for ATP, and your aerobic supply and your CP supply does not keep up with demand. So why do you think you breathe heavy when you exercise? What is one of the reasons? You need oxygen, right. Why does your body want oxygen? Thinking about these three mechanisms.
To do aerobic cellular
respiration. Think about how many ATPs you make for each of these processes. Aerobic cellular respiration is the most efficient process to make ATP. You make on average 34 to 36 ATPs per glucose molecule. So yeah, you'd breathe heavy too to get that oxygen back in your system. That is the best way to make a big amount of ATP. How about questions so far on those topics? That's pretty heavy duty stuff. So if you're just, go ahead, Melissa. I have not, but I'll go ahead and pass it for you right now. Thanks for reminding me. So in terms of sitting still, not exercising, you use aerobic respiration. During the first 15 seconds of exercise, what do you use? Yeah. The mouthful, right? Creatine phosphate or CP, okay? And if you continue to exercise, now you have to supplement with what process? Yeah, anaerobic cellular respiration, good.
So during rest,
Rest is actually going to be aerobic respiration. During the initial startup of exercise, you supplement with CP.
So what were you saying during CP then? The second question you asked?
I might have said something like, if it's 15 seconds of exercise, it's the first 15 seconds, right, and then you burn through it. I do want to mention that third process, anaerobic respiration, will produce painful lactic acid. And painful lactic acid can actually lead to muscle fatigue down at the bottom of your page. Painful lactic acid. So if you have painful lactic acid from that third step there, anaerobic respiration, that can lead to muscle fatigue. Most of us have never experienced true muscle fatigue. If you're a marathon runner, you know, sometimes you'll watch on TV, like during the Olympics, somebody always collapses across the finish line. You're thinking, you know, they're being a drama queen or drama king because they're just so happy they made it to the finish line. In fact, if you have run 26 and some miles, you may have experienced true muscle fatigue where the muscles cannot respond. Even if your brain says, legs move, your legs say, oh, I'm out of ATP, I can't make it. And they just, they collapse. Yep. So let them rest, let their body build up some ATP, and then you can probably get them to move again. So normally muscles need a good supply of blood. They need oxygen to make aerobic respiration happen. We also need ATP from one of those three resources, and we need them to not be damaged. If we're looking at muscles that have these kinds of resources, then those muscles should operate. But if you start starving the muscle tissue of one of those resources, then that's when we experience true muscle collapse and fatigue. Related to that is oxygen debt at the very bottom of your page. Sometimes it has a very fancy word, excess post-exercise oxygen consumption. Basically, this is oxygen debt, and it's the reason why you breathe faster after exercise. You're trying to repay your debt and get enough oxygen back into your body. Give them what in order?
Just like some points in the middle.
Oh, I was going to let you guys work on those on your own. I can check them with you Wednesday. Just remind me. Yeah, just remind me. I was going to let you answer them on your own, and then I'll come back and give you answers.
So oxygen debt is?
Oxygen debt is you're in anaerobic respiration. Ideally, you should be in aerobic respiration. It's the most efficient way to make ATP. Very bottom, it's that. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
EPOC.
Going from one to the other.
Right, trying to get back to aerobic respiration. Okay, so oxygen debt is what happens when you're exercising. You are trying to get back to aerobic respiration. It's the most efficient way to make ATP. And since you're in a debt, you're having to breathe faster to repay your debt. Once you've paid off your oxygen debt, your respiration rate returns back to normal. If you remind me on Wednesday, I'll go over those answers middle of page 90 with you. I'd like to get you started, though, with a little bit of the nervous system today. That is it for muscular system. Do you have any questions so far? For the answers. That was, yeah, anaerobic. That's all right. That's good.
You might as well just go ahead and give her a brain work.
Call it a day.
Good.
Okay, just want to touch on a little of the nervous system for you today. We're going to get just a little bit into it, and then Wednesday we'll hit the nerve impulse transmission full on. Let me start you off on page 92. Once again, if you've never used GetBodySmart.com, it's a fantastic resource to use. They not only have nervous system basics, like how this system is organized, they've also got the physiology up there. So it's a free website, available for you to use, and I do recommend it. It's a great place to get some outside help.
Get Body Smart.
Get Body Smart. Let me start you off with the organization of the nervous system. I bet you never thought it was this complicated. The nervous system includes a central nervous system at the very top. You'll notice that includes the brain and the spinal cord. The central nervous system, you'll notice, is broken apart into two functional divisions. A sensory division that brings information to your central nervous system, and there's a motor system that takes information away. Now, the peripheral nervous system is the one responsible for communicating back and forth with your central nervous system. What are the two organs that you find in your peripheral nervous system? Cranial nerves and spinal nerves, good. Okay, so let's go down to your chart on the bottom. For your central nervous system, the structures found there are brain and spinal cord. Central nervous system structures are brain and spinal cord. Peripheral nervous system structures are spinal nerves and cranial nerves. Central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. Peripheral nervous system is spinal nerves and cranial nerves. In this picture, they're showing us the central nervous system, which is in fact central. Your brain and spinal cord run down the medial portion of your body. Branching off are all these spinal nerves. Branching off the brain are the cranial nerves. And so those cranial and spinal nerves communicate back and forth with your brain and spinal cord. They're the ones that carry sensory information to your brain and spinal cord and motor information away from. Carry sensory and motor. That would be a good function to jot down. For peripheral, the function is to carry sensory to the CNS, which is central nervous system. Carry sensory to the CNS and motor from the CNS. Okay, peripheral nervous system function is to carry sensory to the CNS and motor from the CNS. Talking about functions, what do you think our central nervous system does? Yeah, it's like a decision center. Yeah, sends out impulses. It's a control center. That's a great way to sum it up. Good. Central nervous system is a control center.
So it's more like the messenger?
It's not necessarily the messenger. It's the one that makes the decisions on how to do stuff. It gets the messages and sends out the decisions. Yeah. The wife, the boss, whatever you... All right. There are two functional subdivisions of your peripheral nervous system. They are sensory and they are motor, because those two kinds of relationships go in to and from your brain and spinal cord. So under the next column, are there any functional subdivisions for the PNS? We have sensory and motor. For the PNS, we have sensory and motor. Sensory info is oftentimes called afferent information. Afferent because it's going toward your central nervous system. So in terms of the last box there, the function of a sensory component is to take information where?
To the CNS.
To the CNS, good. The function of your sensory component is to take information to your central nervous system. Take information to your central nervous system. And the function of your motor component is to... Good. Carry information away from your central nervous system. Okay, the motor component takes information away from your central nervous system. Speaking of sensory and motor, let me help you fill in some blanks on the next page.
This class period got really fast.
It did, didn't it? Okay, top of page 93, you'll notice up there functions of the nervous system. Here, once again, is the sensory information and motor. Sensory input comes from receptors in skin and muscles. Sensory input comes from receptors in skin and muscles. Sensory receptors are like tattletales. They're going to run to your central nervous system, brain or spinal cord, and tell what they know. The brain or spinal cord does number two, which is to perform integration. And then, of course, the output comes from your brain. That's where a process is initiated, and those are what we consider effectors. We're going to go to effectors like muscles and glands and tell them what to do. So the blanks there for number three. We go to effectors such as muscles and glands. Are you all familiar with neuron structure? Yeah, like axons, dendrites, cell bodies, good, okay. That is going to be something we talk about in here on Wednesday. You may want to go ahead and review page 94. You may want to complete what you can. And if you have an opportunity to read ahead for Wednesday, take a look at pages 95 on. Keep in mind this test runs through page 103. A lot of that information is a repeat. Okay. We'll see you guys on Wednesday. Yeah. Somatic is body. It's not autonomic, which is automatic. We'll get more into that as we get further into this stuff. Okay, let me write them down for you.
Yeah.